Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, Congress is on its Thanksgiving break, and it's a good thing Republicans and Democrats won't be spending the holiday together. With tensions as high as they are, the turkey and everything else would be flying. Last Friday night, the House of Representatives was in an uproar after Republican Congresswoman Jean Schmidt attacked Congressman John Murtha, a decorated Marine veteran, for calling for a pullout of troops from Iraq. Schmidt quoted a constituent who was a soldier.
He asked me to send Congress a message, stay the course. He also asked me to send Congressman Murtha a message that cowards cut and run, Marines never do. Danny and the rest of America and the world want the
Gentlemen.
Assurance from this body that
House
we will
the
see
House
this
will.
Through.
The House will be in order. The House will be in order.
Well, over the weekend, the White House appeared to be tempering its attacks on Congressman Murtha. And just moments ago, in a speech at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., Vice President Dick Cheney praised Congressman Murtha as a good man and a friend. He said that his remarks about Democratic war critics were taken out of context, but Cheney continued to point the finger at Democratic senators.
What is not legitimate? And what I will again say is dishonest and reprehensible is the suggestion by some U.S. senators that the President of the United States or any member of his administration purposely misled the American people on pre-war intelligence.
Rick Klein is a reporter with the Boston Globe. He joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. And, Rick, I know you listened in on some of the Vice President's speech. Tell us more about it. What did you make of it?
Well, I think it really had two purposes. Earlier in the speech, I think responding almost directly to what Representative Schmidt said on Friday, the Vice President made the point that Congressman Murtha is entitled to his opinion and the Democrats are entitled to their opinion. But then in the second half of the speech, he was very strong and really even stronger than he has been in the last week or so in criticizing Democrats for the second-guessing of intelligence and trying to argue that the president misled the nation into war. So I think in the first half there was really a lot of concern that the tempers were flaring a bit too much and that there was a need to tone down the rhetoric. But I think the vice president may have added a little bit more wood to that fire at the same time.
Well, broadening out for just a second, President Bush also over the weekend seemed to seek to tone down some of the debate on Iraq. And the operative phrase seemed to be fine man. Both he and Donald Rumsfeld called John Murtha a fine man. But can you just tell us for a second about Congresswoman Jean Schmidt, a relatively new congresswoman who stood up, as we heard, on Friday night and made these remarks? Was there some concern that there's going to be a lot of backlash to that?
Well, she's actually the newest congresswoman. She was just elected in a special election because the previous representative from that district in Ohio became the U.S. Trade Representative, and she actually beat a veteran of the Iraq War in a very close race. It was a very Republican district, a lot closer than a lot of observers thought it would be, and the Republican candidate, Ms. Schmidt, won, and the Democratic candidate, like I said, an Iraq War veteran, was an anti-war candidate. So she came to Congress largely because of the strength of her pro-war credentials, and I think within the Congress, there was a lot of realization that she's a freshman member, one of the newest member of the House, and maybe wasn't familiar with the rules or protocol in terms of criticizing other members. But I think broader than that, I think the White House and Republicans generally thought it was a bad sign for members of Congress to be seen as attacking a man like Congressman Murtha, 37-year former drill sergeant, Marine veteran, served a couple of tours in Vietnam, a few Purple Hearts, and really one of the leading Democratic voices on defense issues. I think attacking him could backfire, and I think there was concern. I think that's why you hear from the president and vice president a bit of the toning down.
Well, in fact, Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican from Nebraska, said last week marked a turning point for the U.S. in Iraq, and he made those comments after the Senate passed that resolution calling for significant U.S. troop cuts in Iraq beginning, next year. What's your sense, though, of what happens next? Congress on a break now. What is your sense of what will come of this high volume?
I think the turning point was really the first major congressional intervention in the war. The Senate, of course, as you say, calls for 2006 to be a period of progress toward transition to full sovereignty for the Iraqi government. And in the House, just an all-out raucous debate on Friday about the war. I think that's a troubling sign for the Bush administration. They've been able to count on at least implicit, if not explicit, trust from Republicans in Congress who are in control of Congress through the conduct of the war. But I think moving forward, if there's more concern about the conduct of the war, that means there'll be more efforts to rein in the administration on issues like detainee treatment, which has been a big item of contention recently.
And what about
contracting is another thing.
And what about personnel, Rick? I just want to ask you, in the less than a minute that we have, there's been talk that President Bush is angry with the vice president for Cheney's rosy prediction about a swift victory in Iraq. Do you see anything coming of that?
Well, certainly nothing public in terms of they have a very mysterious relationship, and it's been described as a very close working relationship. And the kind of conversations that they have, there's seldom anyone else in the room, even a close aide isn't in the room. So it's hard to say exactly. I think only two men really know the true depth of the relationship. But I think throughout the president's tenure, he has shown some willingness to be quite independent of the vice president. I think what we've learned about the run-up to the war is that the vice president Cheney was a lot stronger about going without UN approval, and the president listened to some of the other voices within his own cabinet suggesting that he should go to the United Nations. I think today, though, we saw a vice president who's again attacking, but attacking on the kind of terms that the president is comfortable with. And I don't think there's really a lot of light between the two men in terms of their position on the war, the conduct of the war, certainly not when it gets into the public realm.
Rick Klein, reporter with Boston Globe. Rick, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, as Congress debates withdrawal from Iraq, the U.S. military is trying out a different strategy in some of the most violent parts of that country, leaving troops and experts behind in towns that have been repeatedly swept of insurgents so that soldiers and experts can help with security and reconstruction. The strategy is being used in Afghanistan, but it has not been employed in Iraq, partly because with only about 160,000 U.S. troops there, the military is already spread thin. The result is that U.S. troops have had to go back several times to cities like Fallujah and other communities in western Iraq, where insurgents keep popping back up. We'll have more on the new thinking in a moment, but first, there were some reconstruction successes in the early days of the invasion of Iraq. One soldier was able to reestablish order in one town, and he's now written about it for foreignpolicy.com. Major James Gavrilis is a career Army Special Forces officer who served two tours in Iraq. He's now a counterinsurgency expert at the Pentagon. He joins us on the line. Welcome, Major.
Thank you very much.
And in this fascinating article for foreignpolicy.com, you write that on the day Saddam Hussein's statue fell in Baghdad, you became the mayor of the town of Arutba in Anbar province in western Iraq. Well, first of all, here you are mayor. What was your mindset going into Iraq? Were you thinking you might have to immediately run a town?
No, that wasn't one of our primary missions. We had a lot of other tasks to do. And civil administration was not going to be one of those critical ones.
So what happened?
Well, the situation changed on the ground, and it became necessary for us to stop the looting and restore some order and stability.
Right. We know the town was occupied by the Fedayeen, the militia loyal to Saddam Hussein. You fought them with your men from the outskirts and then moved into the town. But you write that before you even moved into the town, you had been making contact with Iraqis who lived there.
Right. We always sent the message that we were at war with Saddam and not the Iraqi people.
So when you rolled into town, you already knew some people in there, but what were the very first things you did?
Well, one of the first things we did was organize the city officials that remained behind and appointed one of them to be the senior leader in the city. We wanted to get Iraqis in charge of the city, a civilian Iraqi in charge of the city, as fast as possible, and within 2-3 hours after entering the city, we had that. We had an Iraqi interim mayor. And gradually, over time, we pushed more authority and more autonomy to the Iraqi leaders that we appointed.
Now, I want to make it clear. You're sort of flying by the seat of your pants at this point.
Right. A lot of it we made up on the ground, but it's really developing the situation and adjusting to the realities on the ground.
Yeah, this is an area the size of New Jersey. You had six 12-man teams. You had about $3,000 that you spent. So tell us some of the first tactical things that you did.
First was getting the police reestablished, getting them back out on the street in uniform, armed, and at checkpoints to keep out any of the insurgents, or actually at that time they were former regime elements, from coming back in.
Right. And you paid them out of this money that you had?
Yes.
Yeah. You took over the police station because the old chief had fled. You made that your new headquarters. But that police chief came back, and you had a little bit of a problem there. What happened?
Well, he actually tried to organize a strike of police officers and had told all the police officers not to show up to work, and he was trying to destabilize the area and undermine our authority and really undermine the security of the city. And so we weren't going to let that happen, not for even one day. So we had to detain him.
You had one of your soldiers write up a pledge that people took, pledging sort of allegiance to this new Iraq. People began, what, borrowing your cell phones to order food from Jordan?
Right. What we needed was a political renunciation form. We had anyone who wanted to be part of the official government, the new official government, pledge allegiance to the city and not to the Ba'ath Party.
And Major, while this is going on, are you, you know, calling back to your superiors and saying, by the way, I'm running a town here, you know, we're coming up with a pledge? I mean, are you...
Yes, there's no question about it. We kept our command completely informed of everything that we were doing, and we got all the support that we needed from our command.
Was there a sheet that you pulled out once you took over the town that said, here's how to take over and run an Iraqi town once we get in?
No. No, we do not use really checklists because they don't always apply, and you have to develop the situation, and you need to rely on the guys on the ground to make those right decisions.
Yeah.
And they need the flexibility to do what's necessary, you know, from that perspective.
I note at one point there were some tribal sheiks who were complaining of looting, and you discovered that, in fact, they were behind some of the looting. So what did you do?
Well, what I did was I turned the responsibility around, and I held them accountable for the looting. And so I got them to use their men as neighborhood watchmen and to pretty much protect their own property instead of going out and trying to find someone else's to loot. And so that seemed to work.
And Major, tell us some of the other things that you feel that you did as you sort of sussed out the situation to make this work, because it did work. As you say, in about 14 days, you really had things running pretty well. So what were some of the things that would never show up in a handbook but that you did to make it work?
Right. Working closely with the Iraqis every day, it really developed a mutual understanding and a mutual respect. And it let us know who was there to better the community with us. We didn't try to change too much. We didn't occupy any houses, any private houses, any businesses, or any other public government buildings. And that was critical because we lived modestly, and we demonstrated that we were not there to benefit ourselves from our activities there.
And then you had to leave. Then what happened?
Well, we had other missions to do. Civil administration of that city was really not a primary task, and we could only spend so much time on it before we had to move to other areas.
And so, Major, what happened to Arutba after you left?
Well, slowly, some of the former regime elements were able to creep back into the city, and some foreign fighters used the city as a way station. And over time, they became stronger than the local police, and they were able to intimidate the local police and intimidate the local government.
So it all fell apart. Major James Gavrilis, we'll have more on the other side of a break. You're listening to Here and Now. We'll continue our conversation with Army Special Forces Major James Gavrilis, a counterinsurgency expert at the Pentagon who served two tours in Iraq. And on the day the statue of Saddam Hussein fell in Baghdad, he unexpectedly became the unofficial mayor of the town of Arutba, which had been overrun by insurgents. He writes about the success he had in 14 days turning that town around and also the aggravation at seeing it all fall apart when he was forced to leave the town. He writes in foreignpolicy.com. And Major Gavrilis, have you and others who had initial success in Iraq only to see it fall apart, has the military asked you to do a post-mortem, if you will, about how to approach and hold a town? Or is it thought that maybe it's too late and the experience doesn't apply anymore?
No, it's certainly not too late, and the experience does apply. And sure, there is an Army lessons learned system and process that takes all the experiences, because I'm not the only one. There was a lot of other commanders who had similar experiences, took similar initiatives, and their voices need to be heard to to get really ground truth.
And I got to say, Major, I'm sorry to say this, but when I hear you say that others had the same experience of stabilizing towns, it makes you a little heartsick, you know, to think that there was, you know, this was happening, but then, you know, it just sounds as if there wasn't enough to go around, and things fell apart.
Well, I mean, I disagree with that. I don't think things fell apart. I think there's a lot of areas where that progress has continued, but you just don't see a lot of attention to those areas. You see a lot of the attention on the areas that are still contested. But many places throughout the rest of the country have continued to progress. And, for instance, over 2,000 reconstruction projects have been started, and many of them completed. But you just really don't hear a lot about those.
On a personal level, do you look forward to going back to Arut Ba'a?
Yeah, I actually do, because I've developed a relationship with a lot of the people there. And it would be great to be able to go back there and continue to help them out of the mess they're in.
Major James Gavrilis, a career Army Special Forces officer who served two tours in Iraq and now works as a political military planner in the Iraq Division of the Strategic Plans and Policy Directorate on the Joint Staff in the Pentagon. Well, what is the U.S. government's latest thinking on reconstructing Iraq, especially in the more violent areas? One indication came from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice last week when, on a surprise stopover in Baghdad, she said that an initial three new provisional reconstruction teams would start to be used in parts of Iraq. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Andrew Basevich, a retired Army colonel and professor of international relations at Boston University. Dr. Basevich, these teams, according to Secretary Rice, are civilian military units. They're meant to move in quickly to dangerous towns such as Mosul, but stay behind when combat troops leave. What do you think of the idea?
Well, it's probably a pretty promising idea if indeed our purpose is to try to build a new political order in Iraq. It's going to take a lot more than three of these teams. We're probably going to take many dozens. And one would want to emphasize that for them to really make a difference, they're going to have to stay in place for not weeks or months, but years.
Does that bring a concern for you?
Well, it brings a concern because it's not apparent to me that either this administration or the American people have that kind of a staying power. I mean, in a sense, although people don't like to use the word imperial or imperialism, we are engaged in something like an imperial project in Iraq. And one could, for example, draw comparisons with the British rule of India in the last century. And in order for Britain to put its imprint on India and to maintain order, required people going not just for 6 or 8 or 12 month tours, but both civil servants and British Army officers going to India for years at a time, in many respects making India their life. Mm-hmm. So if we're serious about reconstruction, it's going to be a massive and very long-term effort that's required.
Well, Senator John McCain has also said he's in favor of these experts coming in instead of just, as he says, sweeping a town free of insurgents and then leaving that town. But he also points out that it would seem as if more troops are needed to do this. Are there enough troops?
Well, I think that the PRTs that you're describing are not necessary. The point is not that they're large in terms of numbers of bodies on the ground, but they bring a very high level of expertise in reconstruction. I think there's a good question whether or not we have sufficient expertise, for example, in our already overstretched special operations forces. But we're not talking tens of thousands of people to do this. We're probably talking many hundreds.
Well, in fact, we're hearing today about a Pentagon plan to restructure the military to bring these kinds of so-called stability operations to the same level of combat operations. In other words, to make it the same high-level mission to train soldiers for the aftermath of war as well as for the invasion. We just heard from a soldier who said that in Iraq he figured out on his own how to reconstruct a town. Now it sounds as if the military is planning to put that more into a formal arrangement. But how big a change is that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a huge change. I read Major Gervilis' excellent article and where he talks about how he arrived in Iraq without any guidance about reconstruction. So, I mean, one might say, why has it taken us so long? to discover the need to place greater emphasis here.
Well, then it brings us back to where we started, which is the point he made, that even if the town is reconstructed in 2 weeks, if no one stays to ensure its stability, it might fall. And that brings us to our last question. Congressman John Murtha, who called last week for U.S. troops to be withdrawn in 6 months, given what we've said it might take to reconstruct parts of Iraq, do you think that that withdrawal can be done?
You cannot withdraw all U.S. troops in 6 months and accomplish the project of reconstructing Iraq, which will take probably 10 years or more. That's the fundamental choice that we face as a nation.
Dr. Andrew Bacevich, a retired Army colonel, professor of international relations at Boston University, thank you as always. Well, still ahead, bad news for the auto industry. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from Now. There's more bad news for the auto industry today. GM has announced that it will cut 30,000 jobs and shut down 12 North American plants by 2008. The world's largest automaker has already lost more than $4 billion this year. Speaking this morning, GM CEO Rick Wagoner says the company hopes to save $7 billion with the restructuring.
Obviously, these are big moves, and I think when accumulated with the other things we're doing are going to be a big help to improve the performance that we've seen, but not in a position today to comment on 06 earnings.
Micheline Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times. She was at today's announcement in Detroit. Mickey, GM had been anticipating 25,000 job cuts. This is obviously worse, 30,000. Is it just not selling enough cars? I mean, is that their biggest problem?
Yes, Robin, one of their biggest problems is that their market share just keeps slipping. If you think about it, General Motors alone had over half of the U.S. car market in 1960, and today it has less than one quarter of the market. Its market share has just been dropping steadily for about 10 or 15 years now. And one of the problems they also have is that their factories are set up so that they can only build one type of vehicle. So a lot of these factories that are closing down can only build trucks, or they can only build cars. And in this day and age, you need to be very flexible. And GM has that capability in a few plants, but not in all of them.
Well, as a matter of fact, we hear the GM announcement. At the same time, Toyota is adding plants because they build more than those trucks. So what does this say about GM's ability to switch with the market?
Well, I think that is the overriding issue here, that these job cuts and plant closings reflect the fact that GM has had a number of chances to introduce vehicles that people want to buy, except, I mean, they'll buy them with big discounts. We saw a big run-up in sales over the summer when they gave out the employee discounts, but on average, they have to incentivize their vehicles pretty heavily to get them to move, and even then, people are choosing to buy Toyotas and Hondas and BMWs and other products.
Things that are more fuel-efficient, smaller.
More fuel-efficient and also the better brand images. I mean, a lot of GM's vehicles have old brands, things like Buick, and Oldsmobile is gone now, but they have sort of a generic rental car feel to them, and people, I guess, sense that Toyota, Honda, the others might stand for something a little more distinctive.
Yeah. Well, we just heard CEO Rick Wagoner say he wasn't in a position to talk about earnings for 2006. Is this his way of saying he can't say for sure if today's news will put GM back on track?
Well, that's a good point. Some analysts that I've talked to have said this is more of a transition plan, that the big thing that will happen in 2007 is that the UAW contract will come open for negotiation, and those negotiations are becoming more and more important in the scheme of things. That's the point when GM and the other car companies can go in and really make cuts that they need to make. And, of course, the union will fight them. So this is just to get us from here until there.
Yeah. And there has been so much speculation about GM possibly filing for bankruptcy, so much so that Wagoner sent out an email Friday of last week to employees saying that won't happen, that bankruptcy will not happen. Is that out of the picture, though?
Well, it's out of the picture for the moment. And before I was Detroit bureau chief for the Times, I was covering the airline industry, and I covered 6 airline bankruptcies. When a company is headed into bankruptcy, you pretty much know it. They run out of cash. They can't pay their bills. They start to put off payments. General Motors is not in that position. They have some very valuable assets, and they have $19 billion in cash. So at this moment in time, they are not in danger of a Chapter 11 filing.
By the way, if GM does decide to switch to fuel-efficient cars and maybe hybrids, how long does that take to build that infrastructure? How can they do that?
Well, GM has had lots of chances. I mean, over 10 years ago, there was a marketing executive brought in, and he was given free rein to get rid of any brands that he wanted, any vehicles that he wanted, and he decided to keep everything. And so it really, if you started today and basically said we're going to have a whole new product structure, it would take about 10 years to work through all the vehicles that are in development now, make changes, and go forward. But I don't think the question is fuel economy. I think that their vehicles are good quality. Some of them are fuel efficient. It's just this whole issue of there are equally as good and even better vehicles out there.
Well, meanwhile, the CEO of GM again said the average age of a GM worker right now is near retirement. Do they think they can achieve these cuts through attrition, as he said, or actually they think they can? Do you think they can?
The one thing that that Rick Wagner did say that I found very significant is that many of these cuts will be achieved through retirements and buyouts. These are not just jobs that they're cutting, and in fact, under the UAW contract, they can't do that. You basically, if you're laid off, you're paid for the life of the contract, and then the issue of your job comes up in the next set of negotiations. So as much as he might like to just cut jobs, he really can't do so. He really does have to use these tools of early retirement and buyouts to get to accomplish
it. Otherwise, he has to pay people who aren't working.
That's right. I mean, the UAW contract has a lot of job security protection, and or at least wage and benefit protection, I guess we should call it, because it isn't job security protection. And so people do get paid whether they are on the job or not, essentially.
Well, meantime, Ford is cutting 4,000 jobs next year. That announcement came on Friday. Ford has lost more than $1 billion this year. Are the two situations the same, different?
Well, the Ford situation is very similar to the GM situation. Ford actually does have some new vehicles that are selling pretty well. One of the problems at Ford is there's been a big brain drain, and part of the reason for that is that Bill Ford Jr., who is a member of the Ford family, is the CEO, and he's never really said, you know, this is my management team, I trust them. You know, he's running the company, and for a lot of young managers and people who are valuable, they look at that and they say, well, if Bill Ford's going to be running Ford, I'm never going to get to run Ford. And they've been leaving the company. They've lost a lot of their senior talent. And I think that's a big issue for Ford that General Motors doesn't necessarily have.
But do they have the same issue of, you know, the changing American appetite, people not wanting trucks as much anymore?
Well, that is a huge issue for Ford. And in fact, in October, Toyota came within 1 percentage point of matching Ford in American sales. And so, you know, they not only have to worry about GM, Ford, and Chrysler, they have to worry about Toyota, Honda, and the others now.
Yeah. Well, Mickey Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times, but you're also the author of The End of Detroit. In the minute or so we have, you're based in Michigan. This has got to be brutal news for that state.
One of the things I was thinking about when I was driving back from downtown Detroit to Ann Arbor, where our bureau is, that, you know, Detroit is very thickly settled, not just with the big car companies, but with these little companies, the design engineering companies, the parts makers, and it's like a layer of frosting over the Detroit area. Everywhere you look, you see something automotive related, and it's really affecting the mood of people here. And I think that the gloom that's just settling over this area is very, very, very worrisome.
Are all 12 of the factories that GM proposes closing, are they all there?
No. In fact, they're spread all over the place. One of the factories that's closing is in Georgia, another in Oklahoma, another is up in Canada. And so this will be felt by a number of different places. But some of the job loss is taking place in the state of Michigan, which is already having a very hard time economically.
Which really can't handle anymore. Mickey Maynard, again, covers the auto industry for the Times and wrote the book The End of Detroit on today's announcements from GM and Ford, job cuts. Mickey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, still to come, we'll hear the music of Portuguese singer Maritza. We need it at this point, and you're listening to Here and Now. Time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air your thoughts. Last week, we spoke with Senator John Kerry after President Bush's speech characterizing Kerry and others as Democrats who voted for the war in Iraq. Well, Beth Horowitz from Tucson, Arizona, called with this comment.
They did not vote for the war. There was no legislation saying we vote to go to war to Iraq. What they voted for was a process that should push come to shove and there be no other alternative whatsoever, then we go to war.
As part of our coverage of the Paris riots, we spoke with a representative of France's National Front Party and referred to them as right-wing and conservative. Stephen O'Shea of Providence, Rhode Island, and others objected. Stephen writes, "Even right-wing isn't strong enough. This is an extreme right-wing party known for racism, anti-Semitism, and jingoism. By all means, interview an NF spokesman, but identify the fellow for what he is. What would you think of a French radio station interviewing David Duke following Hurricane Katrina and identifying him as conservative?" We also spoke recently with Judith Schindel Rothschild of Boston College School of Nursing about how the nationwide shortage of nurses is creating a new problem, a shortage of nursing instructors. Keith Douglas wrote, "I don't know what the answer is, but it isn't fast-tracking nurses into graduate and post-grad programs in order to beef up the ranks. That's dangerous. We are and have been seeing new grads rushing into Masters of Science in Nursing programs to come out as managers and or nurse practitioners with little clinical background to support their new roles." Well, the bulk of our recent mail came in response to our conversation with Elizabeth Marquardt, a marriage proponent and author of Between Two Worlds, a book based on her study that claims to show that even good or amicable divorce damages kids. Marie Artman of Merrimack, Massachusetts writes, "I listened hungrily. Having been divorced with two children, I have searched long and hard for this kind of information. We must never stop trying to find ways to better understand and help kids get through divorce. As I see it, a huge part of the problem with divorce is this. In a normal situation, parents are increasingly in the background as children grow and move towards independence. When there's a divorce, it's all, whose weekend is it? Moms allow that, but dads don't, etc. The parents never get out of the forefront, a strange inversion that denies the children that slightly self-centered space to explore who they are and where they want to go. Thank you for bringing attention to this vitally important topic." We also heard from many children of divorce. Teresa Carbone of Limerick, Pennsylvania was one of them.
I came from parents that were both divorced, and they still are convinced that their children are fine because they went to college and are not on drugs or on alcohol, but yet fail to realize that we have trouble keeping relationships or being in relationships and understanding how a relationship works and how to create a long-term relationship because we have never seen it in action. So I definitely agree. I hope they continue to pursue this more because I think it's becoming popularized to get divorced because we feel that children are not affected at all when in reality they are and just don't have a voice in this world.
But we rush to add, there were many who disagreed with Elizabeth Marquardt. Mimi Burstein of Paoli, Pennsylvania was one of them. She writes, "Although Marquardt later admitted that divorce can be better for children than high conflict or abusive marriages, she seemed sure that low conflict marriages must be better for kids than divorce. She should have talked to me, a psychologist who suffered because her parents remained in a cold, loveless, depressing marriage. I'm all for marital therapy when it works, but some marriages are mistakes." And Marcus Stevens of Bozeman, Montana agrees, adding, "I reject the notion that I would have been better off if my parents had stuck it out. I know for a fact that I have been more successful in my own relationships because my mother gave me the example of a woman who would not settle for too little love. I want my children to value that over the fairy tale conservatives like to promote, that after the wedding we all live happily ever after, or that at least we should pretend to for the kids' sake." Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any topic. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. Meu Fado Meu, My Own Fado, and the singer Maritza has certainly made Fado, the Portuguese blues, her own. Fado was once sung just by older men and women draped in funereal clothing, but Maritza is being called the new face of Fado. With her short blonde hair and fashion-forward wardrobe, she sung with Sting and Peter Gabriel. Born in Mozambique, she grew up in Portugal and now sells out audiences in Europe and the U.S. Her new CD is called Transparente, and Maritza joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Wow. Hi.
You say wow, but they are saying that you are the next great fadista. Is that what a woman who sings fado is called?
Well, yeah, but normally we don't. I learned not to call myself fadista because it's a huge compliment. So we expect someone give that compliment to us.
Well, I give it to you then. You are fadista. And as you know, that's royalty in some cultures. What is your hesitance to sort of accept that crown?
What I feel is, in some way, I'm carrying the culture of a people. I'm carrying a culture who have more or less 200 years. And I'm trying to show outside of Portugal what it is. I think it's nothing to belong to kings and queens, but something who make part of a culture of a people.
In fact, it was sung in the working class neighborhoods of Lisbon and other cities. And let's tell people more about Fado. In English, it translates into destiny or fate.
Yes.
It comes from a lot of places, and so do you. Tell us a little bit about your background.
My mom, she's half black, half Portuguese, with a little bit of Indian in the middle from India. My father is a mix between French, Spanish, and German, and Portuguese, of course. So I'm a very mixed person. But I was born in Mozambique, and I went to live with the age of three. I went to live to Lisbon, to the most traditional neighborhood in Lisbon, where father was born at the 19th century. So I think I didn't have the option, you know, because there, everybody sings fado. Everybody lives their lives like fado. So I think fado was my first toy, my first doll.
Your first toy.
Yeah.
I'd like to listen to a little more. Let's hear Song of Disillusion. At least that's how we're interpreting it. How do you say that?
Toada do desengano.
Let's listen.
Este amor, este meu fado, tão vivido e magoado, entre o sim e o todavia. Este amor desgovernado, marcado a fogo e calcado em funda melancolia.
Maritza, I'm looking at some of the English translation from the liner notes. This fate of mine so vivid and so painful, caught between yes and however, ungoverned love, a deep melancholy, harrowing. This it pulls at me and tortures me, fills up my empty life.
It's not for torture anyway.
Well, you know, you're only 32, and that's what some people have said is amazing, because these fados are so, they have so much yearning and melancholy and hope.
Well,
and
because I think all the Portuguese people, they have that, a little bit that sweet melancholy, you know. Maybe because we are too much open to the sea instead of open to the continent, the European continent, you know. The only thing we had for centuries was the sea. Fado is a music who was born from the black, the slaves and the Portuguese sailors. So I think a little bit of that melancholy comes from that, from us not having nothing, and the only thing we had was the sea and trying to go to the discoveries.
Right. And the slaves in particular, melancholy and homesickness, so the fado was born.
And I think until now, you know, we are living a 21st century, but I think until now that sweet melancholy is passing through centuries to the old generations, to young generations, and we still have it. So that's why in some way, when something happens, we say, oh, this is too Portuguese, you know, because we feel things, normally Portuguese people, if they are melancholic, they are really melancholic, you know. If they are happy, they are really happy. They live life in a very intensive way. So that's why they have this music.
But that's the other thing about fado singers. They're usually shrouded in black and photographed in black and white with one arm over the forehead. And you, by the way, what are you wearing? You have these incredible outfits, and some people in the audience say that's part of the show, seeing what you wear.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
I think people should listen more music and not try to pay so much attention to my dresses. You know, I'm a woman. I like fashion, of course. But with my style, I have my own style. I think all the artists, they have their own personality. And that should appear in the way they dress, in the way they do music. And that's what I do. I don't fix in that cliche of the fado singer with the black hair and black shawl and black clothes. Sometimes I use it, but normally it with my style, at my way, you know.
Mm-hmm. We heard that you once used to sing, James Brown in pop songs.
I used to sing in my teenager age, but I started singing fado with 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And later, I started listening to different styles of music, and I fell in love for a little bit of soul music and some blues and bossa nova. So I used to sing outside of my neighborhood, but inside of my neighborhood was fado completely.
Right, and now fado, your neighborhood's the whole world where you are singing fado. Let's listen to another cut. This is the title cut, Transparent. What are you saying here?
Well, there I speak about my black grandmother. It's a kind of biographic song. It's not totally true, but yes, I have a black grandmother. And yes, she's from Mozambique. And yes, she dreamed one day I could be a singer.
I see a head of plaited hair and the cradling song of the fado. Let's listen.
Vejo cabelo entrançado e o canto morno do fado num chaire de caracóis. Como num conto de fadas, os batuques são guitarras e os coqueiros girassóis.
Maritza, that's another role of the fado, isn't it? To storytell and to be nostalgic in some ways.
Well, you're talking a lot of nostalgic things and melancholic things. This type of music is a music who make the commemoration of all the feelings of life. And we don't pass all the time talking about the melancholy or the sadness. We have a lot of completely different feelings to explore. If you go to a taverna, imagine yourself walking in the small streets of Lisbon, entering a taverna, ask for a glass of red wine, and you see everybody having a lot of fun. They're going to sing fado. Sometimes you listen to melancholic fados, but sometimes you listen to very happy ones where everybody sings and clap and talks about the river, about Lisbon, about wine, about completely different things. So fado is a music who talks about the feelings of life, so we don't pass all the time trying, you know.
We're speaking with Maritza. Her new CD is called Transparent. Say it in Portuguese, Transparente?
Transparente.
Transparente. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Viveu de ser português. Foi alegre, foi gingão. Por ser fado é canção. Por ser futuro é passado. Mal querido ou bem amado. O fado, mal querido ou bem amado. O fado.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.